part 4 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on generosity with Jack Kornfield.
So this evening I'd like to speak about the opposite root, rather than the unskillful root of wanting and grasping that we went through in great detail. The opposite of grasping and greed, which is entitled non-grasping, or openness, or generosity of heart. It also involves the spirit of service, or caring, respect for the world. And most deeply, this discovery of this state, or this capacity for not grasping, openness, involves a radical shift of our identity from who we think we are when we're afraid and limited and contracted to our Buddha nature or our true nature. A poem from Rumi. You know, Rumi always liked to talk about lovers and wine and things like that. A certain man has a jealous wife and a very appealing maidservant who herself is fond of this woman's husband. The wife was careful not to leave them alone ever. For 6 years, they were never left in a room together. But then one day, at the public bath, the wife suddenly remembered that she'd left her silver wash basin at home. "Please go get the basin," she told her maid. The girl jumped to the task because she knew that she would finally get to be alone with the master of the house. She ran joyfully. She flew, and desire took them both so quickly they didn't even latch the door. With great speed, they joined each other. Meanwhile, the wife, back at the bathhouse washing her hair, "What have I done? I've set the cotton on fire. I've put a ram in with the ewe." She washed the clay soap off her hair as quickly as possible, fixing her chador about her as she went through the streets. The maid ran for love. The wife ran out of fear and jealousy. There is a great difference, my friend. The mystic, the spirit, flies moment to moment. The fearful clutches along month to month. What will you choose, my friends? Don't worry. If you are a lover, the length of even one day for a lover can be 50,000 years. So that's Rumi's way of characterizing these different possibilities for us. How do we run from fear or out of love? When I was living as a monastic in the forests of Southeast Asia, and I've talked about this, one of the great pleasures of that time, and really one of the great experiences of my whole life, was to go out in the mornings early for alms food with a bowl. And it's not begging, although that language is used, even though one is a mendicant, because the people wait in the villages just at sunrise with their hands in a prayer position, and they wait for the monks and they offer the food with such beautiful spirit. And they put it in your bowl and you go in silence. You walk on those little dikes between the rice paddies just as the sun comes up. And it felt very ancient, because it was remote villages where there weren't even, you know, cars and radios and things. It was still ox carts. And it was like turning the clock back 1,000 years. And people would wait and put food in your bowl. And you don't say anything. You're not supposed to speak. You just receive it in a mindful kind of way. You can't say thank you for that wonderful fish, or oh, I love mango, you know. It's great. Even though you might feel it, and I did some mornings, right? You just take it. In some of the monasteries where I lived, which were most remote, food was really precious. And in the dry season, which was 6 months of the year, there wasn't a lot of protein. So they would make curries out of water rat and out of bats and, you know, dried fish with peppers and things like that, stuff that would keep through the year along with their rice. And to be offered food in such a place from somebody who didn't have a lot of food was an amazing thing, because no matter how poor we may be as Westerners, still, for most of us in an emergency, if we really need it in the hospital or something, we can call somebody and somebody will give us $500 or $200 or $1,000 or more which is their income maybe for a year or more. And so how do you take food from someone like that? That was my question. You can't thank them. And the only thing I could do would be to go back to the monastery and receive it in sense that they so value the spiritual life and what the monks represent and the nuns that are there in the monastery, what they represent, that they're willing to give even of the little food that they have to have that be part of their life and their community. It was such a beautiful give and take. And the spirit of that generosity, the support of the sacred in those cultures was still very much alive. The same in Burma, which is very poor under this military dictatorship. And yet, the great Shwedagon Pagoda, which is in the center of Rangoon and almost as tall as the Eiffel Tower, has a gold crown at the top, 385 feet tall. This huge pagoda, 1,000, 2,000 years old, they say in the center is the walking stick and some of the hair from the head of the Buddha. A big windstorm, a monsoon, came some years ago and damaged the crown of the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is this golden crown set in jewels. And the word got around in the countryside, and people took off their gold rings. They don't have banks in the villages. The way they store their money, if they have any, is gold. And they took out their golden earrings and they took off their gold rings. And they gave even in a very, very poor time. And they said, we so value the spirit to honor it that we'll do whatever's necessary. And it was restored immediately. The quality of grasping, which we discussed, that strategy is when we come in a room, we see what we want or what we need. If only I had that, that person, that thing, that beautiful, I like this. It's the quality of the whole in us looking to be filled by a person or a thing or an experience. The if only mind, if only I got that, then I would be complete in this life. Until, of course, the next if only comes along. And it comes from a place of impoverishment within us. Now, we can easily feel the sorrow in our times, how lost we are as a culture at large, by looking at every single magazine and newspaper and television show, the kind of advertisements, buy, accumulate, wear, show off, have, this will make you happy. Immortality group meets in Scottsdale, Arizona. Even though a couple of believers have died, those attending the People Forever International Conference, hundreds of them still think they'll live forever. We're a species that has the ability to renew itself, said the leader Brown. The important thing is tapping into the intelligence of our cells, which he did in a cellular meditation some decades ago. Now, hundreds and thousands of people have joined him. The organization serves as a support group for immortals struggling through a world where most subscribe to the cult of death. The group released financial records in January to stop repeated rumors that it was a money-making machine targeting the gullible. The audits did show that each of the three founders received salaries of $300,000 a year, plus housing allowances, Cadillacs, and other perquisites. Brown said he can offer no guarantees of immortality, since cell rejuvenation is an individual matter, and he and others say that several members have died. So, it's nutty, our culture, in some way. What is supposed to make us happy? What will make us happy? Grasping doesn't make us happy. Each state that we spoke of grasping or aversion and hatred of delusion, each of those strategies of fear, basically, can be transformed into an awakened blessing, into an opposite, or discovered as an opposite. So the opposite of grasping is non-possession. And it's a transformation that leads us to the qualities of a Buddha or Bodhisattva in the midst of the world of abundance. That is to say, your very desires, your desire for beauty, your desire for comfort, your desire for security, in themselves they have a positive side to them, very deeply, because within them they show your sensitivity, They show your love of beauty, your love of play, your love of harmony, your vision of the world. They show a recognition of the beauty of the Tao or the Dharma that can be found within them. And so when these qualities are understood, it's not that there's no more wanting or playing or acting in the world, but the fear and the grasping is transformed, and that vision, that capacity, is used for liberation or used as an expression of compassion. That's the quality of a bodhisattva, that whatever circumstances present themselves, I will use this too to awaken and to awaken myself and others. And if it's helpful to make things beautiful, I'll make them beautiful. If it's helpful to live simply, I'll live simply. A kind of generosity that can work with anything. The spirit of the bodhisattva, even if the sun should arise in the west, the bodhisattva has only one way, says Suzuki Roshi. Which means even if the world is turned upside down, the way of the Buddha within us is to take those circumstances and use them for liberation. An old Zen master called Nonoku lived alone in a little hut in the mountain. One night while he was sitting in meditation, a stranger broke into his hut, brandishing a sword, demanding all of Nonoku's money. He didn't even get up from his cushion. He just addressed the man. He said, "All my money's in a bowl on the shelf up there. Take all you need, but leave me 5 yen. I have to pay village taxes next week." So the stranger emptied the bowl of all the money and threw 5 yen back into it. He also helped himself to a precious vase he found on the shelf. "Hey, carry that with care," said Nonoku. "It will crack easily." The stranger looked around the barren room once more and was going to leave. "You haven't said thank you," said the Zen master. The man said thank you and left. Next day, the whole village was in turmoil. Many people claimed they'd been robbed. Someone noticed the vase was missing from the shelf in Nonoku's hut and asked if he too had been the victim of this robber. "Oh no," said Nonoku. "I gave the vase to a stranger along with some money. He thanked me and left." He was a pleasant enough sort of fellow, but a bit careless with his sword. Because you don't own it anyway. You have it for a while and then it's all gone. It's like the rich man who died and they asked, you know, how much did he leave? Everything. Right? How much you always leave. Even in our grasping, in our desire, in our wanting, in this if only, if you listen, there is really something deeper that we want. If you take a moment and reflect on it, what is it in all the different wantings of your life that you really want? Really deeply. And when I've asked people this question, the answers, when they really reflect, wholeness, love, peace, abundance, somehow a well-being. Not the stuff, but that sense in the heart. Now, there's a confusion in our times about abundance and wanting. Abundance, some people, kind of because of how it's taught in our culture, think it means wanting and getting. Any amount of money, the right car, the right house, the right sexy partner, the right, you know, sexy clothes, whatever it happens to be. And at worst, the kind of abundance consciousness is like, if you think right, you'll get everything you want, you know. And you can sort of tune it up and test it to get the right parking space when you need it, and so forth. This is not true abundance, because it's connected with things. True abundance and generosity is a dimension of the spirit and not of things. Abundance is not dependency on things good or bad. It's not about love and light or pleasant experiences. To experience a true abundance also requires this capacity of our hearts to face the dark and the shadow, to face death as well, and the loss of all things. So again, Zen Master Suzuki Roshi said when he was dying of cancer, "If when I die, if I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. No confusion in it. Maybe everyone will suffer because of the physical or spiritual agony, but that's all right. If you had a limitless life, it would be a real problem for you. If I suffer, that's just suffering, Buddha. Sun Buddha, Moon Buddha, Happy Buddha, Sad Buddha." The abundance of heart of a Buddha is to face all of life, the birth of things and the end of things, loss and fear and selfishness and rebirth again, and know it for what it is. Rilke, when he died, the German poet, at the end of his life, had a very long and painful illness, and he wrote about it with some appreciation. He said, "Whoever does not sometime or other give their full and joyous consent to the dreadfulness of life as well as its beauty can never take possession of the unutterable abundance and power of our existence, can only skirt the edge, and one day when the judgment is given will be judged to have neither been alive nor dead." So abundance means the willingness to open to life as it is, to face injustice and suffering, as Martin Luther King wrote about. You know, "We will soon wear you down with our capacity to suffer in the struggle for the rights of others." He said, "And with that, with our suffering, we will win our freedom and your freedom in the bargain." Abundance also means our willingness to be open to all of this experience in the moment, whatever it is. To face the music, to call a spade, and a turkey, and a rat, you know. And what used to be the War Department and is now the Defense Department and probably is working its way to being the Peacekeeping Department. It's true, right? To call it what it is. To face Stalin and Hitler and starvation on this earth, because we have to do this. And racism. Incredible kinds of pains. And in the midst of them, know that there is another way. Like Viktor Frankl. "We who lived in the concentration camps can remember those who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from us. But one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose our attitude, our spirit, in any given set of circumstances." That's abundance of spirit. So it's not wanting car, money, a long life, a parking space. And it's not fear of the inevitable change and loss of pleasure and pain and gain and loss that change all the time. Buddhist psychology says that's the nature of pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, hot and cold, sweet and sour, birth and death. They all change. That's our life. It's not a fear of that, but an abundance of heart in the midst of it. There's an African proverb. It's the heart that lets go. The fingers just follow. My partner for many years, and good friend in teaching, Joseph Goldstein, practiced for a long time in this little village in Bodh Gaya, India, where the temple of the Buddha's enlightenment tree is. And at one point, his father had died when he was a child. He wanted his mother to come and meet his teacher and see what this was about. So she came to India in her 60s, Evelyn. And she was someone who had grown up with a moderate degree of comfort and was kind of a middle class, person, Jewish. She'd been the owner of a kind of hotel in the Catskills. And had always lived with her, you know, her kind of food and her car and her phone and her heat and air conditioning, all the things that kind of make life comfortable. And she went to India and she was given what was a reasonably nice room in this Burmese temple, which meant that she had her own room. And it was a concrete slab floor and it was about 8 by 10 or 8 by 8. And there was a wooden bed on it with a little kind of cotton mattress and a little table, and that was it. That was the best digs there were in the monastery. And when she first arrived, she was somewhat taken aback by the simplicity of the modesty of it, if you will. She stayed with Joseph and she went to the Bodhi tree and she talked with his teacher Manindra, who's very sweet and very personable and generous in his own way. She stayed for a while, a month or 6 weeks. And by the time she left, she said, you know, I didn't have anything here. I didn't have a phone. I didn't have a car. I didn't have my comforts. I didn't have my things. She said, it was about the happiest time of my life. That simplicity. It was so wonderful. Because it's not the stuff that makes us happy. In fact, the stuff a lot of times is suffering. Haven't you noticed? We've talked about the principles that underlie the problems of the world, the sorrows of the world. And the world does not need more oil or food or energy, all these kinds of things. It needs less greed, less fear and less prejudice, less me and mine, less selfishness, less tribalism and less racism and less raping of one another. That's what makes us unhappy. So in Buddhist psychology, happiness is not born of grasping. It cannot be. Whether it's to your children or your own body or your possessions, that doesn't make us happy. And so as we meditate and pay attention moment to moment to our experience, we can discover this. The complementary states, when there's grasping and when there is letting go. And this non-grasping or abundance is really born out of an awareness of, in this moment, of our connectedness with the rocks and minerals of the earth that make up our food body, with all the animals, you know, all the insects that make the food that you can eat and keep the plants and pollinate and do all that. That's part of your life. And the water that's in the streams and in the clouds and in the oceans, that's abundant for us all the time. We get water with the sunlight, with the leaves, with our parents and children and community members who all the time are making electricity or running our hospitals or tending our roads or moving our mail or planting food, which the earth then gives back to us. Incredible abundance of just being alive. Now, it used to be a chief function of the healthy relationships of children and parents and the villages to give a child a sense of this abundance as they grew up. Some of us, unfortunately, didn't get it. And I know at times when I've done storytelling and teaching some of the schools, like Caroline's, my daughter's schools and stuff, what I notice sometimes, especially I remember among little boys, that a lot of these 5 and 6 and 7 year old boys would come up after I'd drum and tell stories and just hold on to my legs. And it turned out a lot of them were from families where they were being raised by a single parent or a single mom. So all of those kinds of difficulties. And they were just hungry for some man to be with. In the Onondaga Iroquois nation, in upstate New York, one of the ceremonies that's done for young children when they grow to be 3 or 4 or 5 years old is that the tribe will come together and the child will be placed in the center of the circle with this abundance of drink and food and warm clothing, beautiful things, and first be given every wonderful kind of food to eat. And then after they've eaten all they can, someone from outside the tribal circle will call out, "I'm hungry, I'm hungry." And the members will say, "Do you hear that person?" And after the child is eaten, they'll take the food and they'll go feed that hungry person. They'll come back and be given wonderful drink. And someone will cry out, "I'm thirsty," or given wonderful warm robes and cloth. I'm cold, I'm freezing. And after the child is all wrapped up and feels this great warmth and abundance of the tribe, then they go and take the other clothes and give them to others as they have. It becomes a function of meditation itself, of spiritual teachings and teachers, to remind us, to help us rediscover this inner well-being and wholeness and abundance that we long for. To discover in our own hearts that quality of the bodhisattva or the Buddha. The bodhisattva, sattva means being, and bodhi means awakened, a being committed to awakening. And in a sense, everyone who makes even the first turning toward a life of the spirit, a life of awakening to compassion and awareness, is a Buddha awakening in that moment, is a bodhisattva. The vows of bodhisattvas are, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Imagine that. Or desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The Dharma is boundless. I vow to master it. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. Those are the traditional vows of a bodhisattva. Beings are numberless. I will awaken them all. Now, when you think about that, it seems like a pretty tough task when you have trouble, you know, with just the people in your own home. And you think, how am I going to awaken all these other beings when, you know, my partner, my kids, my parents, my roommates, they're not awakening from what I'm doing so much, you know. It seems like a big task. And it is if you do it from this small sense of self that gets frightened or grasps. So it really speaks of a shift of identity again. To understand that we are all in it together. As I love, we all love. As I awaken, we all awaken. There was a farmer whose corn always took first prize at the state fairs. And he had a habit of sharing his best seed corn with all the farmers in the neighborhood. Somebody said, why do you do that? And he said, it's really a matter of self-interest. You see, the wind picks up the pollen and carries it from field to field. So if my neighbors grow inferior corn, the cross-pollination brings down the quality of my own corn. That's why I'm concerned that they plant only the very best. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
That's the spirit of the bodhisattva. It's not for somebody else, but it's for us as a family of beings. So when we speak in this practice of mindfulness, mindfulness is the king or the queen, the chief state for bringing this freedom. Because in a moment, there arise sights and sounds and tastes and smells and thoughts. Pleasant ones, unpleasant ones, neutral ones. Without mindfulness, we grasp the pleasant, try to hold on, or we get afraid or get upset at the unpleasant ones, and we fall asleep or don't notice the neutral ones. But with mindfulness, there's a sense of this dignity, of royalty, of our Buddha nature, of king and queen, that sees the light and the dark, the 10,000 joys and sorrows. Yesterday here we had a day of meditation for people of color. It was a wonderful day. African American, Latino, Asian American, Native Americans. It was really beautiful to have a room full of people from those different cultural backgrounds. And I think they felt a great joy and support from one another. It's, as I said, like the first day, this man stood up and said, I'm the only black vegetarian Buddhist doctor I know. It feels really good to have, you know, some friends. And we did our usual sitting and walking meditation. And after a couple of walking meditations, people were coming in saying, we talked about it. What was it like to just do a walking meditation and be mindful? I said, oh, it reminded me of my childhood, of the leaves crinkling under my feet. Or I took my socks off and I walked out there on the gravel path. And I really felt what it was like to put my foot on the earth, on the gravel and then on the grass and then on the ground itself. You know, or I was standing there and I could feel the sunlight like my skin was drinking it in, which it does, you know. So mindfulness brings us this capacity of being alive here. And then out of that deep attention comes abundance and joy and appreciation. It awakens in us this sense of spirit that we're born from the body of the earth, from our mother's body, from the rain body, the sunlight body, that we eat the earth, and then we give back to the earth, that it's all Buddha, the food of the Buddha being put by the Buddha into the Buddha, back to the Buddha. Help us to find the divine, they cried to the teacher. No one can help you. Why not? For the same reason that no one can help the fish find the ocean. If you're looking for eternal life or the eternal, the timeless, it's here. Where else could it be? It's not in the future, I assure you. That's a thought. The eternal present. What we seek, what we long for, is here when we awaken. Denise Levertov, a poem called Taste and See. The world is not with us enough. Oh, taste and see, the subway Bible poster said. Meaning, if anything, all that lives to the imagination's tongue, grief, mercy, language, tangerine, weather, to breathe them, bite, savor, chew, swallow, transform into our flesh, our death, crossing the street, plum, quince, living in the orchard, and being hungry and plucking the fruit. To be alive. We all have a deep longing to give to the earth, to give to others that we love, to give the society and world around us, to work, to love, to care for things. And when people can't, it's a tremendous loss, a grief, a sorrow. How can we do this? We start simply here and now. Again, the mystic poet Rumi says, you say you can't create anything original? Don't worry about it. Create a cup from which your brother or sister can drink. That's simple. So in discovering this state or this quality of non-grasping, of openness of heart, of generosity, which the Buddha talked about as the ground of happiness in spiritual life, as an expression, he said, we can cultivate it, nourish it, practice it, develop it, work with it, remember it. And the development of happiness in giving has different qualities. It's traditionally talked about. First, there's tentative giving, whether it's of things or time or energy or whatever. Oh, I have this. Maybe I'll need it. I should put it in the attic. Nah, you know, it's going to clutter up my attic and maybe I don't really need it. I could give it to Salvation Army or the school or something. Maybe I'll give it. Nah, you know, I should keep it. I could. And you go back and forth and I say, all right, I'll give it away. That's tentative giving. Remember that one? Right? And even that is beautiful. By the time you finally do it, say, oh, you don't need that. What a pleasure it is to give it to someone else. So you respect that. You respect wherever it is that you are in giving. And then there's brotherly or sisterly giving. As your heart opens further, it's not, do I need this or not, kind of that still the body of fear, but I have this, let me share it with someone else. It's such a pleasure. Won't you also enjoy what I have? And you can feel how much more happy, expansive that is. Tentative giving, then brotherly or sisterly giving. And then finally there's royal giving, kingly and queenly giving. And that's when your happiness is so joyful from giving that you give the best that you have. Because the pleasure isn't in having, the pleasure is in the joy of sharing. This is the best that I have. Enjoy this. Let me appreciate your enjoyment of it. And you can feel, as each of these is described, the degree of happiness that comes with each. We can play with these and cultivate them and practice them. Because we each have so many things to give. Generosity of space. Generosity of silence and listening. Sometimes just to listen to a person is a very generous act. To not be formulating your words, but just listen. The simple ones, it helps to do a daily meditation for that kind of generosity, just to be still in yourself a little bit. The generosity of our smile, the generosity of a touch, the generosity of our vision and commitment to justice in little ways and in big ones, or love. This is from Mother Teresa. When I visited Australia, I paid a visit to an old man no one knew existed. I was being taken around to these old rooming houses, old age homes, and his room was in horrible condition. I wanted to clean it up, but he stopped me. "It's all right." I kept quiet, and finally he let me go ahead. Now, in his room was one beautiful lamp, but it was covered with dust. I asked, "Why don't you light this lamp?" He replied, "What for? Nobody comes to see me, and I don't need a lamp." Then I said to him, "Will you light the lamp if the sisters come to see you?" "Yes," he said. "If I hear a human voice, I'll light it." So the other day he sent me a word back, many months later. "Tell my friend that the lamp she lit in my life still burns constantly." So generosity can be such simple things. In fact, mostly it is. Sometimes it's our honesty, even if it means to say, "I'm exhausted, I'm burned out, I'm tired. Are you okay?" That's a generous act, just to speak truthfully. Sometimes in our own healing, generosity means that we're generous with our own suffering and sorrows and care for ourselves as well. And of course, it can mean our time, our help, our money. One of the practices that I've done for a number of years now is that if I have a thought to give something, I do it. If I have that thought that comes, I do it. And it's interesting, there's this little book of a Roman man of wisdom, Epictetus, I guess you would say, called Manual for Living. I was reading through it. It's quite nice, actually. And I read through, and all of a sudden I came to one of his kind of instructions, which is entitled, "Never suppress a generous impulse. Follow through on all your generous impulses. Don't question them, especially if a friend needs you. Act on their behalf. Do not hesitate. Don't sit around speculating about the possible problems or losses or dangers. As long as you let your reason lead the way, you will be safe, I'm sorry to say." And it's been a wonderful practice because I don't have any regrets about it. You know, you don't regret it. You just do it and you don't regret it. You move on and you're happy you've done it. So that's a way of practicing. Sometimes our generosity is simply our blessing. And I learned this in some ways, especially from being with, teaching with Robert Bly. Because he asked people all the time, especially the elders in the room, the older men and women, "Have you given your blessings to the younger people around you recently? You know, how many times in the last weeks have you admired the young men and the young women, complimented them and honored them and blessed them? Because they long for that so much, to be recognized." What an incredible thing. Yeats, in his poem from his 50th year, speaks about this sitting in the tea shop in the window in London. He discovered the secret of life, golden and complete. "For 20 minutes more or less, so great was my happiness to discover that all that matters is to be blessed and to bless." To give our blessings. And all this comes from that sense of our own abundance. So with attention, there grows forgiveness and kindness. Those are a kind of generosity. Respect is generosity. Letting go. When Ram Dass asked his teacher, Maharaji, "How can I get enlightened?" He said, "Love people. Feed them." Ram Dass said, "But I'm talking about enlightenment." He said, "Love people and feed them. I want to find God. Love people and feed them." Because in the end, it's never ours to possess whatever we have. We just rent it. We get it for a little while, even our bodies. To love people and feed them, it is both a path, and you can practice it in all kinds of ways and see if it doesn't make you happier. And you have to include yourself in the circle. You can't be generous to everyone else but moi. Right? Both as a path that you practice and as an expression of your awakened heart, of your own Buddha nature. For the end, the last truth that you discover in generosity, most honestly, if you look at it, is that our giving and our deepest service is never done for somebody else, for money or love or helping or whatever, that it's really always for ourselves. And that's not a bad thing, it's a beautiful thing. That if you've done hospice work and sat with someone who's dying, and you care, you're wiping their stuff that's dripping out of their mouth and, you know, changing their bedpan and doing stuff like that, it is a privilege to be with somebody as they die. And it's not for them, it's for us. You know? It's like Gandhi. Someone asked Gandhi, you know, why have you lived this life this way? Why do you always stress this simplicity and giving and so forth? And Gandhi said, I never do it for anyone else. I do it for me. And really honoring your heart, you awaken the hearts of everyone else. That's what true awakening is. And it's liberation and happiness and freedom and a life without regret. What a thing to live a life without regret. Mm. This is from Didi Lal, who's a wonderful woman saint from the medieval times in India. I searched for myself until I grew weary, but no one I know now reaches the hidden knowledge by means of striving. Then, resting in just this, I found the place of wine. There all the jars are filled, but no one is left to drink.
This concludes part 4 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Our program continues with part 5.